for Pacifica Radio, August 17th, 2020. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. All right, you guys, welcome to the show. It is Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. I'm the editorial director of antiwar.com and author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. You can find my full interview archive, more than 5,000 of them now, going back to 2003, at scotthorton.org and at youtube.com/scotthortonshow. All right, you guys, on the line, I've got Bronco Marchteach again. And here he is writing last year for In These Times. He's also, of course, at a Jacobin. And he wrote the book Yesterday's Man about Joe Biden attacking the left from the left, of course. Here, welcome back to the show. How you doing, Bronco?
Hey, great. Great to be with you, Scott.
Happy to have you here. And at issue, Kamala Harris, Joe Biden's pick for vice president. And now we know all about the police state she helped run in California back when she was in charge of that. But here she's been in the Senate for a little while and has somewhat of a record. But also, like you write about in this piece from last year, she's made some friends and has found a clique to run with. And they're not the good guys. The article is called Meet the Hawkish Liberal Think Tank, Powering the Kamala Harris Campaign. And I know every listener of this show right now already knows what you're going to say. Go ahead.
That's the Center for a New American Security.
Ah, which... of course. Okay. So, well, go ahead and dive in. Tell us, obviously, again, she's had some limited experience in foreign policy, but she's left somewhat of a paper trail and plenty of indications about where she's going here, right?
Yeah, I mean, so just to explain what the center of, or the CNAS is, it's basically the foreign policy equivalent of the Center for American Progress. So this is a nominally liberal corporate-funded think tank that is meant to be kind of the in-house vehicle for a establishment democratic foreign policy.
It was really created at the end of the Bush years for the incoming Hillary Clinton regime.
Yeah, exactly. And then when she lost, they seamlessly transitioned to being in the Obama administration. And Michelle Flournoy, who was one of the co-founders of SNAS, she ended up being in the Obama administration until 2012. She was in sort of the Secretary of Defense in waiting for Clinton in 2016, and she lost. Kind of made her way into the Kamala Harris campaign as a possible way to get around the setback. Harris obviously lost in a very or dropped down in a very embarrassing way, but Flournoy is still being floated for the Biden administration as a Secretary of Defense. So you're likely to see her come back. And you know, there's other SNAS alums in the Biden campaign. For example, Julianne Smith, who was also one of the people that Biden nominated to write the Democratic platform. She's also his foreign policy advisor. She's a senior fellow there. So this think tank and that the worldview of Michelle Flournoy that was coloring Kamala Harris's foreign policy during the campaign, that's going to be a big part of the Biden administration, most likely, if it happens to actually win power in November.
And if it kind of rings a bell, but you're scratching your head, their first big project was COIN and the whole fad of the counterinsurgency doctrine as implemented by King David Petraeus, and how it was going to save Afghanistan if only we would triple the war there. And that was Flournoy's job. She was secretary, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Doug Feith's spot, in charge of winning the Afghan war, which she lost.
Yeah, and you know, you could look at the CNAS report in 2016 that they put out, which I believe was called Extending American Power, to get an idea of what Flournoy and you know, her ilk want to do with American foreign policy. And it's basically exactly what is a carry on from you know, the Obama years and before. You know, it, aggression against Russia and China. She was a big advocate for sending lethal arms to Ukraine, which Trump has obviously done at this point. She wants a more extensive war against ISIS and terrorism in general. She also wants to double down on things like the U.S. exploitation of fossil fuels, even at the same time as she's saying that climate change is a major global threat. This is one of the things that she said, the U.S. for its own security needs to actually export more fossil fuels. Slightly contradictory. I'm not really sure how that's squared. I would say, and probably the more cynical among us would say, she's probably just saying the climate change is a threat stuff to sort of win over liberals and to sort of make the right noises to make the Biden administration sound like it's going to be progressive.
And now I noticed here in your piece, you mentioned the presence of former Secretary of Defense William J. Perry. And I wonder if you know if that's anything more than ceremonial, because that would actually make me feel a lot better because, he is a guy who in his retirement has decided to become a real crusader against nuclear weapons and for nuclear arms control. And I wouldn't feel too bad if I thought that he was going to be around badgering these people from that point of view.
Well, I think he was on the board initially. Whether he's on it now, I'm not sure. If you look at the CNAS's, the papers it puts out and just its website, its foreign policy is very clear. Regardless of who is on there, it's very much that kind of liberal interventionism that has been a disaster under Obama and really under Bush as well.
And since Bill Clinton, that's who it is, right? It's the DLC, Bill Clinton, third way Democrats from the 1990s still, right? And who's Joe Biden other than Bill Clinton's wife, right? He's the same guy, the same group with all of these guys.
Yeah, it's kind of depressing doing these interviews because people are often ask me, bright spots and what kind of thing can we expect from Biden, whether on domestic policy or on foreign policy? And I can't lie. Unfortunately, there's not really that much. Especially on foreign policy, this was something that unfortunately, the left or the progressive side of democratic politics does not really have very robust or influential institutions that they built around this. So the matter of foreign policy was completely left off to Biden. Sanders' foreign policy, I'm not sure, how much you covered it or your listeners were aware of it, but Sanders' foreign policy was above and beyond better than every candidate that had run. Would have been better than every president for I don't know how far back I would go, but decades if he had had the chance to implement it. But unfortunately, he didn't make any attempt to pressure Biden on foreign policy. Those unity task forces that we heard about so much, foreign policy was left off completely. And so in the platform, all these planks on Israeli occupation of Palestinian land, they were defeated. For example, they're not even referring to the Israeli occupation that was defeated. There's a thing in there, there's a language in the platform that says something around, ending endless wars, which is encouraging. But unfortunately, the platform is only one piece, and it's, unfortunately, the weakest piece, because Biden himself is really someone who spent his career saying one thing and doing another, telling people what they want to hear. And so it's really going to be, yes, it's great that they want to end forever wars, but there was a piece from Michael Hirsch in Foreign Policy I was just reading, where he talks about how Biden boasted to him privately that he was the one who got Obama to kind of hedge his language on withdrawal from Iraq when he was elected vice president. So is this the guy, especially if Michelle Flournoy ends up Secretary of Defense, is this the guy who's really going to make that platform plank about ending in this wars a reality? I hate to say it, but I'm skeptical.
Yeah, there's this narrative that it kind of makes sense that he was a bit, chastened by the role that he had played. He really was the most powerful senator leading the Democratic senators into Iraq War II. And that was such a disaster. And his son died because of it. It was only years later somebody finally beat it into his head that, your boy's brain cancer came from the burn pit from the war you started. And so finally, I guess that was what it took for him to realize that, oh, gee, maybe I shouldn't have done that after all or something. I don't know. But then they say that he advised Obama. Well, I know that he advised Obama against COIN and the surge. He wanted to leave 20,000 troops in Afghanistan to ignore the Taliban and just fight invisible, non-existent al-Qaeda forces there or something kind of thing like that. The minimal option was the Biden plan. And he supposedly advised against Libya. I don't know what he really told them about Syria, but he did kind of give that speech or that talk to at Harvard where you could tell what he thought about Syria there, where he explained what we all knew, that these al-Qaeda guys ain't moderate rebels, and it's not all the CIA, it's our allies too, but they're backing some really bad guys there and all of that kind of thing. But then, you know, at the same time, he sure didn't stop Obama from going to war in Libya. He didn't stop Obama from backing al-Qaeda in Syria. He was unable to restrain him from launching the genocide against the civilian population of Yemen in 2015. And so, you know, sort of, I think, like what you were saying there, geez, if his staff really wants to do something, is he really going to resist them? I mean,
yeah. And I think it's also important to note that Biden was also, according to reports, behind the basic foreign policy modus operandi of the Obama administration, which is drone strikes and special forces strikes. You know, like we won't put too many boots in the ground. We won't invade. We won't do regime change. What instead we'll do is we'll do these, minor, in scare quotes, which you can't see, minor incursions into mm-hmm. other countries' borders and violating the national sovereignty, kill wedding parties and farmers and children and so on and so forth, drive that anti-American anger that's been fueling anti-American terrorism, but without doing it in the regime change way where people start protesting and they get angry and they oppose it. So that was Biden was apparently a big proponent of that. And that's really, if you look at Michelle Flournoy's writings, she used to be one of these people who, she actually drafted the policy document that set up the two war doctrine. Made it official policy, was the U.S. has to be able to fight two wars simultaneously at the same time.
Really? What year was that she did that?
That was in 1998, I think.
Okay. Very interesting.
Yeah. But then she, that's been criticized, and I think she came to kind of turn away from it as well. Not because, it's insane, the idea, why is it that a country needs to fight two wars simultaneously? I mean, think about what that actually means. There's no country on earth that has that need. But she turned against it because, in the more modern style of warfare, she argued that it wasn't necessarily something that was needed. It was, it's increasingly sea and air power that's in modern wars, it's the main thing. So, that all fits very well with this this Biden policy of, drone strikes and special forces killing people in the cover of night.
Right. And, part of this is his senility, too, I think. Where when Trump's making noises about pulling out of Afghanistan, he immediately, this just goes to show the political tone deafness too, he immediately criticizes that and says that's wrong. Not only will I keep 20,000 troops in Afghanistan, I'm going back to Pakistan. When the Obama-Biden drone war in Pakistan ended about halfway through Obama, it was basically a first-term war. And it was horrible at the time. But in the last 4 years, or at least the last 3 years of Obama, it was over. They did maybe one or two strikes here or there, that kind of thing. When Trump came in, I think he did one in Pakistan. The CIA isn't fighting a drone war in Pakistan. And Biden is talking about the whole situation like it's still 2009. And we're going to do the Biden plan, 20,000 troops in Afghanistan and increase the drone war in Pakistan. That's crazy. There's nobody left to bomb there. All the Arabs, they either kill them or they escape back to Yemen or Libya, wherever they were from, where America could call them moderates and take their side.
Well, you know, war as launched by the DC foreign policy establishment is never about anything rational. It's a profoundly irrational project. But, you know, I'll be careful with that because I don't know if you know, but it's not okay anymore to point out that Biden may be a little bit past his prime, you know, when it comes to some of his thinking.
Oh, does that make me ableist? Is that the new ruling?
Well, the line now is that pointing out, you know, the fact that Biden kind of does these long rambling sentences that go nowhere and that he seems to forget about halfway through, that's actually just criticizing his stutter. That's the kind of line that they've been running on. So keep that in mind.
When, look, you know, any fair observer of this, if you don't have a dog in the fight and you don't really care that much, it's obvious to everyone that Trump is as stupid as Biden is senile, and that it's essentially still an equal arm wrestling contest there in terms of mental facility. You know, Trump, I don't think, is really going senile and losing his mind. He just doesn't know what the hell he's saying at any given time. He never did in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly bleak prospect that these are the two men that are going to be competing for president, that there's actually going to be a debate between these two guys.
And he was saying the other day that the Spanish flu of 1917, which is a year early, but that helped to end the Second World War. Which, you know what, look, he went to government school. A lot of people went to government school. And if you're not really interested in history, you might not know when the Second World War was. I don't know, back when, in black and white days or something. I don't know, right? But he's the president of the United States, and he doesn't know when the Second World War was.
Yeah, I mean, it's between that and the speeches about, you know, toilets and showers, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, no, I'm for legalizing toilets and showers again. You know, all this regulation is just insane. Hold on just one second. Be right back. So you're constantly buying things from Amazon.com. Well, that makes sense. They bring it right to your house. So what you do, though, is click through from the link in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org, and I'll get a little bit of a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. Won't cost you a thing. Nice little way to help support the show. Again, that's right there in the margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, check it out. The Libertarian Institute, that's me and my friends, have published three great books this year. First is No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg. He was the best one of us. Now he's gone, but this great collection is a truly fitting legacy for his fight for freedom. I know you'll love it. Then there's Coming to Palestine by the great Sheldon Richman. It's a collection of 40 important essays he's written over the years about the truth behind the Israel-Palestine conflict. You'll learn so much and highly value this definitive libertarian take on the dispossession of the Palestinians and the reality of their brutal occupation. And last but not least is the great Ron Paul, the Scott Horton Show interviews 2004 through 2019, interview transcripts of all of my interviews of the Good Doctor over the years on all the wars, money, taxes, the police state, and more. So how do you like that? Pretty good, right? Find them all at libertarianinstitute.org/books. You need stickers for your band or your business? Well, Rick and the guys over at thebumpersticker.com have got you covered. Great work, great prices, sticky things with things printed on them. Whatever you need, thebumpersticker.com will get it done right for you. Thebumpersticker.com. Back to the nominee for vice president. Can you tell us about Kamala Harris, other than palling around with these CNAS folk during her failed campaign last season? You know, what is her voting record in the Senate? What did she promise Israel in her big AIPAC speech? Or what can you tell us about her real foreign policy record here so far?
In foreign policy, for example, she backed the coup in Venezuela. She's voted for the defense budgets, the gargantuan defense budgets under Trump. She actually voted against the Sanders Amendment just a couple of weeks ago to cut the defense budget by 10% and reinvest it into health and you know, other sectors back home. So, you know, generally she kind of gets point to as a pretty liberal member of the Senate, because since 2016, because she's seen the writing on the wall, she's really comported her voting record to be, you know, one of the further left people that was going to be running for president. But I think some of these examples show you that there's a limit to that. And, you know, yeah, very much a big supporter of Israel, you know, did a speech at AIPAC and everything. So, you know, foreign policy, unfortunately, there's nothing in her choice that suggests that there's going to be any sort of turn away from the last, you know, decades and decades of the direction of foreign policy. And unfortunately, right now, I hope this is not the case in, you know, 5 months' time, or whatever it is. But right now, there isn't really any of the energy on the ground to push the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, of course, to the left in foreign policy. It's all aimed at domestic, which is, you know, understandable given the crises that are roiling this country. But it just means that a Biden administration with Harris in the VP role is, you know, not going to have any real incentive to make a dramatic break from what's been going on for the last, you know, God knows how long.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, on the right, they're saying, oh, she's a radical Black Panther from Kenya, or whatever kind of thing that they sure want to try to spin, a secret agent of Bin Laden and the devil and whatever kind of deal. But that's all beside the point. And that'll probably actually, you know, reinforce her credibility with Democrats, that she drives Republicans that crazy, because they are very emotional creatures. It's true.
It kind of reminds me of the Obama era. I feel like we've gone a time warp, because again, we have, well, yeah, it's the right and then Democratic aligned media both discussing and arguing furiously over the exact same imaginary person who does not exist. This
right.
Far left Democratic candidate, you know, Obama in 2008 and, you know, to 16, and now Harris.
Yeah. Absolutely right. As the great James Bovard said regarding the Waco hearings back 25 years ago, but it works for everything. Watching the Republicans and the Democrats fight is like watching drunks fight in a bar. They swing and they miss. And so that's the deal. They hate each other, and that's good, but it's always for all the wrong reasons, and none of their makes any sense at all. You know, one thing about that was supposedly was going to have some kind of effect on Obama's governance and supposedly would be part of Kamala Harris's is all of these modern day leftist identity politics, and maybe to the good and maybe to the bad. But that, depending on who you are, then your policies are supposed to, you know, completely and totally reflect that. And she's obviously extremely late to the game, but is racing to do her best to get to the front of the whole social justice parade here and Black Lives Matter and all of these things. And yet one of the very best parts of, and there are a few very best parts, but one of the very best parts of the social justice modern day PC movement is that Palestinians count. And that all of a sudden, you know, whatever different kinds of oppressed and powerless groups of people here are supposed to now include Palestinians as having lives that matter. And as you well know, there's not much of a rational case to make against that. And so what you have to do, the Zionist movement overall just has to lie and dissemble and omit half the truth all the time and speak of the Palestinians as though they're foreigners and not already conquered subject peoples and all of these things and the promise of a two-state that'll never come and all of this stuff. And so, but does this mean that Kamala Harris is going to have to, you know, it obviously it's not because of her heart, but because of political pressure, she's going to have to bend and say that, look, I will not be tolerated if I refuse to call this apartheid like it is, which is exactly where the entire left half, at least, or at least maybe the left third of the liberal, socialist, progressive left is on this issue. You know, I think more than that, at least half, probably, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what percentage. I mean, certainly among younger people, you know, Israel has really fallen out of favor and there's increasing support for Palestinian rights. And I think that the entire party is turning that way. But I think there is a resistance among some of the older crowd of Democrats. I mean, you know, what you're saying is I would love that to be true. But the fact is that the way that the identity is kind of used by a Democratic Party, it's incredibly selective. And so you're absolutely right. I mean, if those principles that they espouse were to be applied consistently, then yeah, we should be, the party should be talking about Palestinian oppression and Palestinian lives, which are brutalized in a remarkably similar way by Israeli forces as African Americans are by, you know, law enforcement in the United States. But of course, in the U.S. context, and even actually in European countries, for instance, identity is more likely to be invoked as a way to suppress Palestinian speech or even pro-Palestinian speech, because any criticism of Israel and Israeli policies gets kind of contorted as, well, this is actually hate speech against Israel and against Jews. So, you know, I don't think she's going to feel a lot of pressure to do that. She's definitely not going to do it by herself.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have to consider if, you know, she herself obviously is African-American. If she spent the bulk of her career brutalizing other Black Americans, what is the likelihood that she's going to really go on a limb for Palestinians?
Nah, very little. And I sure didn't mean to sound, I'm not sure that you misunderstood me, but it occurred to me that the audience might have misunderstood me. I sure didn't mean to imply that the Democrats are any good on this. I meant the kind of cultural movement out there, the social justice type movement. They seem to be pretty good and pretty consistent on this. When, you know, after all, I mean, to me, that's really impressive because most Americans, I'm sure the super majority of Americans, don't even know what the West Bank is or that it's been occupied and conquered since 67. And what is a Palestinian Authority? Is that a government or are they trustees in an Israeli prison or how does that work? Americans don't know the first thing about that stuff because TV will never explain it ever. And so the fact that you have the modern leftist kind of, you know, the more agitated part of the left, activist part of the left, being, you know, well enough educated on this to be solid on it, to me, is really great and gives me some hope because nobody else cares.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, we should say that you know, people involved in Black Lives Matter and you know, the overall struggle for racial justice in the United States, I think that they are seeing the connectedness to what is happening to Palestinians and how it's all kind of part of the same system. So I think that is encouraging. You know,
and after all, it's ridiculous, right, to say that the Black civil rights movement is anti-Semitic. Like, oh, come on. Professor Griff says the J word once every 25 years. There's no we're not talking about Nazis. We're talking about leftists. Come on.
Yeah, it's extremely cynical. Yeah.
Yeah. And I like Professor Griff anyway. I don't care about this stupid crap. But anyway, so now I wanted to point out this great paragraph in your In These Times piece. And I'm over time, so we got to cut it here. But it's you say, it's not difficult to suspect the link between CNAS's corporate funding and their foreign policy. And then you list the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars that CNAS takes in from Northrop Grumman, Boeing, Lockheed, Raytheon, BAE Systems, as well as the banks. And looks like you got an insurance company or two, some oil companies in Silicon Valley. Wow. It makes you wonder whether Michelle Flournoy or these people are actually human at all or whether they're really just corporate mascots, you know?
Yeah, well, and just before we shut off, we didn't get to talk about today, but I would advise everyone to look up West Exec Advisors. This is a consultancy firm that Michelle Flournoy and other you know, various government and national security officials set up after the Obama administration. And I mean, you know, this is the the embodiment of Washington money-making, where people from government positions then leverage those positions and the connections they've made in them to make money in, for basically multinational corporations. Biden's advisor, Julianne Smith, she's from West Exec, obviously Flournoy's as well. There's a great piece of The American Prospect by Jonathan Geyer that goes into the history of it. So I'd really recommend people to look that up.
Right. And I'm trying to remember now because, see, I got what Biden's got. Is I did just interview somebody about that. Oh, but they wouldn't do the show. It was somebody who wrote an article about their article and had some more stuff. Was it, I guess it was Kelly Vlahos, right, audience? Was it Kelly Vlahos I interviewed about that? Anyway, it's in the archives there somewhere recently. I really am going senile, and I'm only 44. What's my excuse? God, man.
Well, it's just a stutter.
Oh, that's right. Sorry, gotta go. Thanks, dude. Appreciate it very much, Bronco.
No worries, thanks.
All right, you guys, that is Bronco Marchteach, and he wrote the book Yesterday's Man about Joe Biden, and he writes regularly at Jacobin Magazine, and here he is from last year, inthesetimes.com. Meet the hawkish liberal think tank powering the Kamala Harris campaign. All right, y'all, and that has been Anti-War Radio for this morning. Again, I'm your host, Scott Horton, editorial director of antiwar.com and author of Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. Find the full interview archive at scotthorton.org and at youtube.com/Scott Horton Show. I'm here every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. See you next week.